Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. If slavery is America's original sin, lynching is its capital crime. So noted the opening lines of the New York Times review of Paula Gidding's definitive prize-winning biography of Ida B. Wells, Ida, A Sword Among Lions. Today on Counterpoint, we're going to hear the story of Ida B. Wells' campaign against lynching. To tell that story, with me today is Paula Gidding's, renowned professor of Afro-American studies at Smith College, one of the founding figures of African-American women's history. Paula, I'm so glad to have you here on Counterpoint.
It's great to be here, Jonathan. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Paula, I want you to help us draw a portrait of Ida B. Wells and why she matters to Memphis history. In the 19th century, she was one of the most well-known African-American women in the world. But a lot of people today don't know her story. Can you start by telling us why Ida B. Wells should be known to all Memphians?
And as you know, not just Memphians, but certainly she cuts her political teeth in Memphis, and she becomes radicalized in Memphis. She's born in Holly Springs, Mississippi. She's orphaned there in Holly Springs by the yellow fever epidemic, and an aunt takes her in Memphis, and she begins her career there as a school teacher. And later becomes famous for insisting on sitting on a first-class ladies' car seat on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway. She's extricated from that seat. She's forced out of it. Not without a good struggle, though, as anyone who knows this part of her story, but will later take that railway to court and actually win the lower decision. And this was very important. This is a period of time when civil rights legislation is beginning to be rolled back. Blacks are struggling to sustain the gains they had made during the Reconstruction period. And this is why she becomes famous in Memphis, because that case had national import. It will be later talked about in the very famous Plessy versus Ferguson decision some years later. Her day job as a school teacher in this period of time, this is when she's in her 20s, but begins to understand that the rising violence, she begins the nation's first anti-lynching campaign in Memphis in 1892.
Well, you've telescoped some of the highlights of what ends up happening early in her career, but she also then goes on and becomes a women's rights activist a little bit later in her life. She's involved in investigative journalism from an early age. So in a whole number of avenues, we're talking about someone who was a pioneer as far as civil rights is concerned, as far as women's rights is concerned, as far as anti-lynching is concerned. Let's dig a little bit deeper into her story so that we get a fuller picture. Take us back to her beginnings that you talked about. She's born in 1862, as you said, in Holly Springs, Mississippi. Her father's named James, her mother's named Lizzie Wells. They were both slaves when she was born. And the turning point of her life was when they both died, a day apart, of yellow fever in 1878. With those two dates, 1862, 1878, as frames, tell us a little bit more about Ida B. Wells' childhood before she came to Memphis.
She is the firstborn of six siblings in Holly Springs, when the whole family is orphaned, as well as a young child, the yellow fever epidemic.
Tell us a little bit about yellow fever, because this was obviously a key moment in Memphis history, impacted the whole city in dramatic ways.
Yes, it actually changed the city. It changed the population of the city and the nature of the population of the city. Most of the people who died were poor people, were Irish, were the Irish people, were African Americans. Others, the German elite, left Memphis, really went up the river to St. Louis and other cities. So it really changes the population. Yellow fever was a horrible disease. If you look at the symptoms of tissues, you sort of almost bled to death from within and lost control of lots of your functions. In your last stages, you vomit a black liquid coming out of your body. And I say these details because it's really important to think about the psychological impact of a disease like this in a period that's a Victorian period, when control over your body and over your mind is so important to everyone. So you can imagine what kind of impact that this disease had. And if you read the firsthand accounts, it's just harrowing. As bodies are in the streets, people are afraid. People don't know what causes it. This is before people understood that it was mosquito bite that caused yellow fever. And they were afraid that it was contagious, which it really wasn't. So it just had a tremendous impact all over in that entire Mississippi Valley area, particularly.
But already at a very young age, her parents shaped Ida in very formative kinds of ways. Tell us a little bit about how they had already shaped their daughter in those formative years.
Her father, Jim Wells, was a talented craftsman. He was actually brought to Holly Springs, Mississippi, to the Bowling estate. Aspires Bowling was the owner of the family, was an architect and one of the leading architects in Holly Springs. Jim Wells was a trained carpenter, even though he was enslaved, and was brought to help build these mansions in Holly Springs. Her mother, and Jim Wells was the son of his slave master and an enslaved woman by the name of Peggy in nearby Tippah County. He meets Elizabeth Wells, or Lizzie Wells as she was known, who's also brought to the Bowling residence to be really a cook for the family. And if you understand something about Holly Springs in that period of time, Holly Springs is just about 40 miles away from Memphis. It's actually a commercial little town. It's a resort town. And there are all kinds of very interesting foods that are available in terms of vegetables and meats. And so to be a cook there, to be a prize cook as her mother was really, she was really making cooking into an art. The very important part of certainly the Wells story and of Wells' life and her own political consciousness is when blacks were able to vote for the first time after the Civil War. And of course, there was lots of coercion and of trying to get the blacks, not the black men, not to vote in that period of time, and certainly not to vote for the Republican ticket. But James Wells, despite that pressure, did go and vote, voted for the Republican ticket. And when he returned to the Bowling household, he found that the doors were locked against him and that he was no longer welcome as a worker in the Bowling household because of that.
And what was his response?
Well, what he immediately goes back to town, as the family remembers it. He went back to town, bought some tools, because his carpentry shop was also locked, bought some tools for himself, and then went and established his own business, and was pretty successful. He seemed to be very successful as a carpenter there in Holly Springs. He's also, as the 19th century peers would call him, a race man. Very involved in the community. He was a political leader. He helped to found the first freed schools for African Americans there in Holly Springs. An important figure in a central figure in the community. Her mother, Ida, always wrote about in her own autobiography as someone who, despite what she had been through in slavery, and she'd had a very different experience, where James's experience was much more a paternalistic relationship that he had with his family. Elizabeth Wells had been sold several times into Mississippi and recalls being beaten quite severely during her life. And despite that, Ida Wells would write about that she was a woman of great optimism, of great determination, went to school after the Emancipation Proclamation, went to school herself to learn to read, went to school beside her children, and a disciplinarian. As Ida writes about, every member of her family, they all had what they were supposed to do in the family. They were all religious. They all went to Sunday school every Sunday. In fact, Elizabeth Wells won an award for Sunday school attendance. And so really gives the family a sense of discipline and organization as well.
And obviously a strong emphasis on education, and Ida B. Wells had gotten an education. But everything changes when in this two-day period, both of her parents die, and then some family and friends get together and want to disperse the family. Tell us how Ida B. Wells responded at that moment to the news that the family was going to be broken apart.
Friends of the family had gathered to talk about what to do with the children. And without consulting Ida, who was 16 years old at the time, had decided among themselves to parcel out the siblings to different relatives and friends of the family. And when Wells heard of the plan, she said, "Well, absolutely not." She said, "My parents would turn over in their graves if they thought that we would be separated." She knew that there was some money left by her father had left the family some money. They did own their little house there in Holly Springs. And she said, "What you need to do for me is to help me find a job teaching in the rural areas there in Mississippi, and I will support the family myself." And this is what she does. She insists on this, and she does become the substitute mother for the family and takes care of the family the best she can.
And then in 1880, her aunt invites her to come to Memphis. And Memphis really transformed Ida Wells. It gave her all kinds of new opportunities for cultural development. She was now not only a school teacher, but also a member of the Lyceum, Pola, tell us about the Lyceum, this group that Wells belonged to, and how it was really symbolic of the changed circumstances of African-American life in the age of Reconstruction.
The Lyceum was an organization of teachers there in Memphis, and one of the things they did, they edited their own newspaper. There was poetry readings. They discussed events of the day. They read literature. They even did theatrical readings of classic works, including Shakespeare, which Ida comes to love. And it is typical of what is happening in the 1880s throughout the country. As blacks are getting more and more educated, you know, one black leader at the period said, this is a period where it was like a whole race trying to go to school. And blacks were really succeeding remarkably in this period of time. There was also, in terms of illiteracy, drops dramatically in this period of time. And there's also a group of more elite blacks, such as the school teachers, many of them who went to liberal arts colleges and universities. A number of Memphians graduated from Oberlin, others from Fisk and other colleges. And they felt that literature also was a kind of symbolic and reflective of uplift. And so it seemed to be quite a lively group. And Ida begins to understand she always has this something burning within her. And she does find now an outlet in terms she's elected editor of the newspaper. She is, as I mentioned, she studies Shakespeare and is involved in a number of readings. She actually takes elocution lessons at this period of time. She meets others and her best friends, and she doesn't have many friends. She's a difficult personality in lots of ways. But the friends she does make comes out of the Lyceum as well in these relationships. And when you look at some of the literature that comes out of it and what people are actually writing as a part of that Lyceum, it's also a way to express everything that they've been through, the deaths of loved ones in the yellow fever epidemic and in other instances of parents who were lost, of siblings and spouses who were lost. So this was a very important for her, for Ida Wells and her development, as you mentioned.
So in all kinds of ways, the Lyceum really was symbolic of not only this cultural efflorescence that was taking place, but that itself was based on the economic upturn that African Americans were experiencing for the first time in this new era of freedom. Now, you mentioned earlier when you introduced Ida B. Wells that she began to draw a lot of public attention that resulted from this lawsuit against the Chesapeake, Ohio Railroad Company. The case arose 70 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus. Ida B. Wells refused to give up her seat on a train. She initially won the case. It was overturned. Give us a little bit more information about what happened. Why was Ida B. Wells kicked out of her seat on the train that she was riding? And how did she respond to that?
You had your first class so-called ladies' car, which was, it wasn't by law all white yet, but it was certainly moving that way because of who a lady was supposed to be. And a lady in that Victorian sense of a cult of true womanhood, of a certain kind of person of a certain class who dressed a certain way, who spoke a certain way, who was, you know, religious, etc. And that was being more and more defined as white, but not quite yet. So this is where the battle is really going to start. Then there was something called the accommodation car, which had no gender designation, but in fact was the car for first-class ticket holders among African Americans. On this particular occasion, Ida Wells buys a first-class seat for the first-class ladies' car. The train pulls up. She looks into the accommodation car, and people are smoking. A white man, she says, is smoking in the car. So she says, in fact, well, this is no longer a first-class car because this behavior shouldn't be allowed in that car. So she then goes into the first-class ladies' car. Well, you can imagine she feels the eyes on her, but she ignores them. She had bought a newspaper. She's reading her newspaper. A conductor finally comes up to her and says, this is the first-class ladies' car, and you need to go into the accommodation car. And Ida says, no, I bought a first-class ticket. I'm a lady. In other words, the accommodation car isn't a first-class car anymore, and I'm going to stay here. Well, the conductor asks her a second time, and she refuses to move. And finally, he brings some other help with him and tries to physically extricate her out of the seat, at which time she holds on and tries not to be moved and, in fact, bites the hand of the conductor who is wrestling with her. And you know all this because there's actually the case files are available, which one can read. Despite this, they do finally pull her out of the car, but she won't let them throw her out. What she just says is, fine, I will leave the car on my own. And at this point, you know, her dress is torn, but the conductor has been bitten. The white passengers in the first class ladies' car applauds when she looks like she has lost the struggle. She gets off of the train, and she immediately goes to a black lawyer who is very well situated in the Republican Party and will sue the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway.
And she initially won that case, and some of her writing was about that railroad lawsuit, and this will launch her future career in journalism. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and I'm speaking with Paula Giddings, who will be the keynote lecturer at Rhodes College's sesquicentennial celebration of Ida B. Wells taking place on October 29th and 30th, part of a citywide celebration of Wells at the end of this month. Giddings is Wells' definitive biographer. Paula, now let's jump to the defining moment in Wells' life on March 9th, 1892, when she learned the three men that she knew, including her really good friend Thomas Moss, had been lynched. Their crime had been to compete with the white-owned grocery across the way. When a mob invaded the store, the African Americans shot back, and they were arrested and jailed and then pulled out of jail by a lynch mob. Tell us the story of the People's Grocery and how it led to Wells's editorial, Eight Men Lynched.
As I mentioned, this is a period of time when blacks in Memphis and across the country are really beginning to make some economic gains, to be independent, to create social institutions, to get educated. And there were opportunities in the South and in Memphis particularly, because this is a period of time after the Civil War when the cities are rebuilding themselves and there's work available. And Thomas Moss, who is also a postman, his day job was a postman, which was a very important job in that period of time, particularly, you know, you had to pass a federal civil service exam to be a postman. And this is how Wells met him. He would deliver mail to her in her newspaper office. By this time, she is a co-owner of the Memphis Free Speech newspaper. And she talks about she and Thomas Moss would have discussions. He also taught at the Sunday school where she taught in church and became very good friends. In fact, she was the godmother to Thomas Moss's daughter and was friends with Thomas Moss and his wife. He owned a grocery just outside the city limits of Memphis. An important part of the story is that it was a co-op. In other words, it was co-owned by a number of black citizens in Memphis, Tennessee. And Moss, besides being a friend to Wells and to others like Mary Church Terrell, then Mary Church was also in Memphis at the time and was good friends with Moss. In addition to them being friends, I mean, he was also the symbol of what was happening, what could happen in the New South with African Americans. He worked very hard. He had always saved money in the Freedmen's Bank. And then he takes on as the president of this co-op in the grocery. The grocery, as you mentioned, competes successfully with a white-owned grocery in the same area. And the owner of the white-owned grocery is provocative, is always trying to get Thomas Moss and the black men in trouble. There was a scuffle. It turned into a kind of a mini riot. And in the end, Thomas Moss and other members of the grocery are blamed for the disturbance. And this is why Moss is arrested. And he is said to not go very easily, and in fact cursed out the the so-called sheriffs. The grocery is actually attacked by sheriff's deputies in the end. The men, including Moss, said they didn't know that they were sheriffs because they weren't dressed with any kind of legal emblems. And they shoot back. And several of the deputies are shot. But not killed, but seriously, seriously injured. So that now the whole city is now up in arms. And as I mentioned, Moss and the men are arrested. And eventually, on that night of March 9th, masked men come into that jail, take out Moss and two of the other men who worked at the grocery, take them outside of the city limits into an abandoned railway yard, and actually torture them and shoot them. But shoot them in such a way as shooting their fingers off first, shooting a hole in the cheek of one of them because one of the deputies had been shot in the cheek by blacks. And even more maddeningly, after this lynching, the newspapers brag this was done in an orderly way. It was done in a quiet way. It didn't even wake up the people around them. They were congratulating themselves on the way that this justice was meted out.
And now, on the basis of the fact that Wells's good friend, who she knows about, has been lynched, it really opens her eyes to the fact that lynching really is not about the rape of black men and white women, that this is what she calls The New Lie, and she publishes this editorial called 8 Men Lynched. And in the aftermath of publishing that, effectively, they call for the lynching of whoever it was that had published this editorial. She had done so anonymously. Wells was luckily already on her way to New York. Otherwise, she may well have been lynched. The call to do so was discussed at the Cotton Exchange, not by riffraff, but by Memphis's elite. And it was tacitly endorsed by the Commercial Appeal and other white Southern newspapers. So, Paula, let's just take a step back from Wells' story and talk a little bit more about lynching. A lot of people think that lynching was a few men in hoods doing savage things in the woods, but I have to admit, I was quite surprised to learn that it was such a mob spectacle. Sometimes a huge scene of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. When the police showed up, it was for crowd control. It was announced in the newspapers. Schools were let out so children could come. People took photographs that were even turned into postcards of the burned, mutilated bodies. And there were some 5,000 of these black bodies that were tortured between 1882 and 1968. Help us to try to understand, what was lynching all about?
It is such a difficult question. Of course, lynching begins in the Revolutionary War period. It's named after a man by the name of John Lynch, whose brother, in fact, founded Lynchburg, Virginia. And in the Revolutionary War period, it was used. Their courthouses were few and far between. It was hard to get to these places because it was the war going on. You couldn't travel safely. And so there was sort of this kind of community justice meted out where people were tried. And often the punishment was often a lash or a number of lashes with a whip or exiled from the community. Lynching sort of follows and goes west as people begin to settle into California. And again, places, frontier kinds of places. It begins to change by the Reconstruction period in the 1870s, and it was used to stop blacks from voting during the Reconstruction period right after the Civil War. But still, it's not until 1886 that more blacks are lynched than whites. That lynching becomes now a much more of a racialized phenomenon. And I mention this because it took a lot of time for people to understand that there was not an equal playing field, that something was really happening. Of what was happening also in science, this is the rise of the social sciences in the late 19th century, where blacks are beginning to be seen as a primitive group that no longer regulated by slavery is now regressing into viciousness and primitivity and as rapists. And so what Wells begins to understand before anyone else, and as you mentioned, partly because of what she sees with Thomas Moss, that these charges of rape and primitivity and animalism, it does not really have to do with lynching. It's really competing economically in many cases, and that blacks are being criminalized. That what we hear that they're doing, they're not really doing. People are making this up for all kinds of reasons. Or because they believe in this science that is now emerging. And when I'm saying science that's emerging, I'm talking about in the Ivy League colleges. I'm talking about the people who are the head of all of the anthropological associations and the sociological associations that are emerging. And this now, this animalistic terror figure of the black male, particularly of the lascivious black female, is now proved, quote, and there is evidence of it that scientists are writing about. So people begin now to think about of saving of evil in the form of black bodies, of free black bodies particularly, of overwhelming communities. And that race has to stay pure in terms of whiteness particularly, that the animal has to be held at bay.
In a sense, you're bringing together a lot of things, but you're telling us that lynching was a terror campaign, that's what Ida B. Wells called it, about maintaining the purity of the racial and political and social order that was perceived to be out of order because all of a sudden now blacks are free, they're beginning to climb the social ladder, they're beginning to participate in all of these kinds of cultural activities that we talked about in terms of the Lyceum. And Wells will end up as the great prophet for speaking truth to the lies that were at work that justified lynching in this period. She does it in the immediate aftermath of her editorial on the basis of the support that she's given by club women who gather at this dinner to raise enough money for her to be able to publish the first of her anti-lynching tracts, Southern Horrors. And then she goes on and publishes a Red Record and a third anti-lynching tract and speaks all over the United States about this, goes to Britain and speaks all over Britain about these issues. She would then go on and become an activist in a number of other causes over the course of her life, but she's not really heralded in the way that she ought to be. I mean, even here in Memphis, we have a sign about Ida B. Wells on Beale Street, but no major monument in the city of Memphis to commemorate her life and work, even though she's one of the most important intellectuals to come out of the city of Memphis. Don't you think it's time for Memphis to welcome Ida B. Wells back from exile for being the prophet who decried lynching, which really was one of the darkest chapters in American history?
That's a wonderful way to put it, Jonathan, absolutely. By decrying lynching, she does more than that. That campaign is really, I argue, the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. And we know that this movement has been so important to America in general. Her ideas around women was really important to, as you mentioned, the Black Women's Club movement, but also to the idea to kind of modern identities around women, too. So I think it was really very important to also to the women's movements that will evolve in this period of time. She's an extraordinary figure and a central figure. And because she was so controversial among others, including among other progressives, she has thus far not gotten her place in history. And I hope that Memphis can do something about that. As you also know, I mean, she's a co-founder of the NAACP. And it's not until the NAACP adopts lynching in terms of its being central to its agenda that the NAACP becomes a viable organization. So she's very important with that. She runs for a state Senate seat in Illinois, the first Black woman to do so. She loses, but she has, by that time, 1930, she has also helped to transform Chicago politics. It's her organization that's led by her and formed by her that, you can argue, is responsible for the election of the first Black city councilman, Oscar DePriest, and taps a nationalistic idea in the Black community to actually have Black representatives and not just deal with the white-led machine in Chicago politics. And you can make a case that she really begins that arc in Chicago politics that led to the election of Barack Obama. She is just a central figure and a central American figure, but certainly central to Memphis, Tennessee, where she learns all of those political ideas formed in Memphis, which will then she will take and really in so many ways illumine the country and the idea of protest politics and mobilization of African Americans and others. The anti-lynching campaign was also an interracial campaign. It wasn't just Black people. So she really is this model. There is no figure coming out of Memphis more important than Ida Wells.
And thank you so much for helping us get more of a sense of understanding why it's time for us to welcome one of our heroes home and give her the acclaim that she so rightly deserves. Thanks also for being with us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I enjoyed it.
To celebrate the life and work of Ida B. Wells, join us at Rhodes College on October 29th at 7 p.m. for Paula Gittings' lecture, Ida B. Wells, A Sword Among Lions, and on October 30th at 4 p.m. for Amy Woods' lecture on the spectacle of lynching and how Wells used photography from these lynchings in her campaigns against it, followed by the original one-act play, Iola, a reflection on Wells' years in Memphis, at 6 p.m. For more information, check the Rhodes College website, rhodes.edu. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally. Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.